You are not innocent in this crime, though I allow you are not guilty, in the sense that up until now, you perhaps were unaware of all that plagued you. But let's not dwell on that fact. I obviously don't need violence to defeat this grunting fetus. I have my nimble wit and the power of the truth at my fingertips. He cannot hide from the truth, which is that he has once again attempted to silence the wrong man. I will not go quietly nor gently. I will rage.
That is the troll who is the narrator of Travis Nichols' The More You Ignore Me. I have actually lost my throat in the course of reading that excerpt, so we'll go straight to the conversation.
Okay, so I am here with Travis Nichols, who is most recently the author of The More You Ignore Me. Travis, how are you doing?
I'm hot, but good.
Well, thanks for braving the heat and coming here. I know it's you come from D.C. It's actually just as bad, if not worse, there.
Yeah, it's the only difference here is that there's blasts of different smells mm-hmm. here. The New York sort of olfactory experience is different than the DC one, but they're both uncomfortable and disgusting.
Yes, so. But it seems to me that you're kind of intimating that the olfactory experience of New York is more baleful than DC.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, at least where I am and where I'm going, it doesn't smell
you're
like
you're dissing Brooklyn from like in the first minute of this show. You're a very politic young gentleman.
Yeah, right.
So let's get into the books. We can argue about DC versus Brooklyn over the course of this. Maybe there might be some sort of
no, I think Brooklyn
metaphorical
wins.
Dialectic.
Yeah, no, I think no question, Brooklyn wins.
So you have written now two novels. You've got Off We Go Into the Blue Yonder and The More You Ignore Me. These might sufficiently be called the epistolary novels for the modern age. But if we go back to things like, for example, Love Letters Between a Nobleman and His Sister, typically we've seen epistolary novels where it is multiple perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
You, however, sir, have decided to go for the singular, exuberant, at times, perspective in both of these books. I'm wondering, are you responding perhaps to some specific strain of digital narcissism? Why put it all into one singular voice for both of these novels?
That's a great question. I think mostly I don't know what I'm doing. And so the idea of trying to take a sort of third-person omniscient sort of classic French or, you know, Russian idea of a realist novel, or even something that takes in that sort of wide swath of humanity and offers up a lot of different perspectives. I've tried it a number of times, and I always end up feeling like I'm not. I mean, it's all lying, but it's more that there's a level of sort of assumed privilege that just makes it that I can't quite do it. I end up feeling like it's puffed up enough that someone would just be like, well, this is all a bunch of bullshit. And I would have to be like, yes, you're right. It is. Whereas coming from a sort of deeply singular place, it's sort of going down to go up, where I feel like in a strange way, I'm able to get more in by hunkering down with one voice. And as far as the sort of letter writing or comments in this case, it's a way to get a certain kind of immediacy. I think the only way that I would say prose, but I guess poetry works this way too, I have to have a good sense of who I'm writing to or for, and so this is a way to sort of jumpstart that process, and so it starts in the beginning, where I sort of think, oh, this is the person that I would be writing to, and that helps where I'm writing from. And then in both cases, it was like, oh, well, this is really the best form for this, so I'm not going to, I'm not going to go ahead and try and break it or reinvent it without when it's not necessary.
But in both cases, it seems to me that it's not necessarily you writing to, it's something inside you writing to you, which in turn gets filtered through a novel that goes directly into the reader's head.
Yeah.
So
that's great.
Why? I mean, I guess this is a way of asking you why this voice, whatever it is, manifests itself in either letters or one long, rambling, digressive blog cover.
Right. Yeah, I really should come up with a good answer for this.
Why do you think it does? I mean, it is obviously intuition. It's obviously something you work very hard to tap into from your deepest heart and all that. We can talk about how you do that, whether you go ahead and lather yourself up into a sort of George Hamilton-like frenzy or simply sit there and at the screen. But but I am curious as to the formality of this, that it a medium is as much a part of this as a solitary voice.
Well, I think a big part of it was trying to find a way in to minds and sensibilities of groups of people that I found difficult, would be the easiest way to put it, abhorrent sometimes. But, you know, this thing that it's like now it's, you know, it's just funny. There's a Twitter handle that's just "don't read the comments." And like every day it just says, "here's another reason not to read the comments." So with "The More You Ignore Me," there were some very particular people that I was dealing with on an everyday basis because of my job at the Poetry Foundation. But they were, you know, essentially harmless. They were basically having fun with reputation and sort of inventing characters. But there was something really, I found myself trying to like interact with a person, because there's this rule of thumb that everyone would say. It's like, well, you wouldn't say anything online that you wouldn't say to someone's face. And I was like, oh, right. So you are taking that tack and you're going to lose, because there's all of these other people who are doing, they're saying everything they would never say. And they're having, one, they're having so much fun, sort of. It was sort of a really dark kind of fun that seemed like it was painful. But they also, there were hints of real inventiveness. And, you know, one of the things that there would be actual interesting thought that then, of course, would get, they couldn't let it go. You know, it'd be something like, I'm sure you've had this experience too, where you like, the amount of text that's being generated is remarkable. So that's one thing. You're like, oh my God, that's amazing that someone could type that much. But then also, there are a number of ideas, and some of them are almost there. And so in probably a really shitty way, I thought, oh, well, maybe I can look at that and try to make them into something that I would think is good. So totally insulting to those people that they're not doing it well and I would do it better. But I can own that, because I think that they weren't doing it very well. And then I thought no one would ever actually want to read a 220-page blog comment, which this novel is, unless it was doing something more than just being your standard comment.
Yeah.
So I thought, oh, well, there is a form, which I guess is to get to what you're asking, that there's a form there that allows for a lot more than many of the other forms that we have. Like, I actually think that, you know, with a lot of poetry and with a lot of fiction, there's not a lot of freedom to do this, that, or the other. That you get a lot more freedom in, you know, if you go, like, if you look at slash fiction, or you look at a lot of other kinds of online writing, I mean, they don't give a fuck about what the form is or whatever. They're going to go wherever. They have this amazing freedom, one, because the audience is there or not there, but also there's some, you know, part of the frontal lobe that might be missing that just allows them to not, you know, check themselves. And I thought, oh, well, that could be really remarkable to try and go with. And
so then, the internet encourages them to speak in this unfiltered, raw, feral, atavistic at times mode.
Right. And you're rewarded, you know, a lot of times rewarded by how extreme you can be. But then also the, you know, the sort of ultimate trolling is that you say something provocative in order to get a conversation going.
Some would call it a rise as opposed to a co-dialogue.
Right, definitely. And, you know, the thing, the sort of tragedy of this narrator, and The More You Ignore Me, is that he is sort of trying to do that, but he doesn't allow anyone else to speak. So there's no discussion that happens. And one of the things that I found interacting with a lot of people like this, and also, you know, not just online, it's definitely offline, everyone has these people in their lives, is that you can get worried about, like, I have felt that, like, oh, I'm coming across with this person, or my relationship with this person is being, I'm not being a good person, or something like that, because I'm getting this reaction. And it took me a long time to realize that it has absolutely nothing to do with me, that it has everything to do with this other person. And they in some ways don't even see me, that I'm being steamrolled and just assimilated into this person's psychosis a lot of times. And so with this, one of the things I was trying to do with this narration is just to show that, you know, it starts out very much about, you know, really about someone else. Like, could there be something that's more about someone else than a wedding? I mean, that seems like that's supposed to be about these people. Truly, and then it, as it goes, it becomes, those people are totally obliterated and they're gone by the end. It has nothing to do with them. And so that's what I've found over and over again. And now, you know, I see it and I think, oh, right, this, you know, you think that if there's a comment on a post that's about, you know, Obama's judicial nominations or whatever, you're like, oh, maybe I'll learn about the nominations. And you're like, oh, no, I'm going to learn about this person. And his almost always.
Or you're going to learn about some really terrible part of the national fabric, as we learned recently with the whole Zimmerman verdict.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to kind of delve into this a little further by looking at both books again. I mean, the central voices in both of your novels, they latch upon a random target. In the first book, it's this woman named Luddy. She has a photograph of, as you described, black eyes, black hair, black dimples, black dress. And in the second book, this most recent one, of course, it's a random wedding site and later, you know, the cooking website. They have little, if any, direct correlation to where these unnamed characters are in the present. And I'm wondering if this is your way of taking a look at the way we approach truth, either through letters or through a blog comment, that we're likely to say the darkest and deepest things that are on our mind if we approach everything indirectly. Or was this just some sort of, I guess, natural crazy salad that any way you actually went into this, you would have this madness?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. I definitely think that I get at a more accurate picture of the world indirectly. I think maybe you know the answer to this. I've always, I remember reading this idea about the Pleiades, that you cannot look at them directly, you have to look at them sideways, and or just glancing, and that's when the only way you'll actually see them. Is that true?
Yeah, I believe so.
Okay,
yeah.
Great. So that's there. It's like the Pleiades. I've thought that often, and then I was just now about to say it, and then I thought, maybe that's not true. So great. At least between us, that's the way it is. I mean, I think that there's one thing that was really formative just in probably, I guess you could say, my adult writing life, when I sort of got my shit together and really felt like I was finding a certain way in which the limited skills that I have are able to be used effectively in communicating what I want to audiences, is Jack Spicer's poetry, but especially his book After Lorca, in which he writes letters to Lorca, who's dead, and talks about the idea of this programmatic letter of one poet writing to another in order to describe his poetics or her poetics, but also just as a way of, you know, he calls it the wastage, that the poems are the real thing. But then, you know, I think he probably knew and was being funny, because the letters are actually somewhat better than the poems sometimes. Anyways, the
and he was also a wide outcast for a long while, which creates a connection with this particular narrator.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a lot of Spicer in there. I mean, it's almost like, it's sort of camping up an idea of Spicer, because he's very sane, and I think there are moments of real clarity in the More You Ignore Me's narrator, but. A lot of stuff where you really, he starts somewhere that you're like, yeah, okay, I can go along with that. And then by the end of even a sentence, you're like, no, that is not where I would go with that. And I think I was interested in that, the idea of this outcast, the writer as an outcast or the poet as an outcast, as someone who, wasn't made for these times. And so then, we seem to be a nation of outcasts in that way, where it seems like if you go on anything, there is this sort of dominant narrative that shows up, and then you have all of these things under it, which is all these people disagreeing and fighting and saying, this is just the mainstream media's version of it, or there's all these people who feel so disaffected, even and often most these people who are actually in power, that there's this the backlash Republican, or this idea of like people who are so swimming in white privilege that they're not able to see that they are, and they feel besieged by the fact that this isn't the country that they feel like they grew up in, or some idea that they have. That all these people that I've romanticized, being writers and poets and artists who are outside of, seem like they're outside of the mainstream, but then a lot of them, when I look back on it, I'm like, oh, well, they're all, a lot of them are straight white men. They're all people who came from basically a middle-class background. A lot of them actually were rich. Turns out a lot of, if you look at the history of, especially post-war American poetry, it's arguably a history of Harvard undergrads. And so it becomes this very weird thing where people try to own their outsideness to an absurd degree. And so I wanted to sort of take that from A to Z with this narrator a little bit. Whereas I think in the first book, that narrator felt and was genuinely outside of things a little more. God, when I say that, that sounds ridiculous that he would be more outside than this guy.
No, I think let me see if I can we could steer the train back on the track here.
Yeah, please do.
You're saying that this narrator emerged in some sense from ruminating upon self-declared outcasts, or people who were labeled outcasts, people like Jack Spicer, who came from the exact same place that every single other great mind came from. I'm wondering at what point this was a sort of I don't want to say ideological thrust, but in what way did this idea help to ground your narrator, the notion of outsider, insider, the notion of, for all of his claims of being banned or of wanting to go ahead and change the world, he is still very much the same. He was given the exact same privilege that everybody else did.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that he's also coming from this, this very, a little bit of the like sort of Southern Baptist idea, or a certain kind of Christianity that really loves conflict, because they see it as like, well, Jesus was persecuted, so that's, we must be, you must be doing something right. Or Winston Churchill's, you can judge me by my enemies. And so there's a lot of that, I feel like, in contemporary culture, and a lot of people, especially in the arts, who are like, if you get people upset, then you must be doing something right. And while I agree to a point, there's also like, no, actually, there are people who are genuinely disagreeing with you that you maybe should pay attention to that viewpoint and reconcile your behavior. But instead it gets people to hunker down into this sense of self and entitlement of that. Every genius was misunderstood at one time, most likely, but that doesn't mean every misunderstood person is a genius.
Yes.
So you have all of these people who are taking all of the outside, trappings of being an artist and claiming that that makes them an artist without any of the inside. And so this guy is not an artist. I mean, he's a frustrated artist, but he can't figure out where he went wrong.
Yeah.
And he won't admit, really, that it was him that went wrong. Like, it's something that he had it all right, but it turns out that everybody else was wrong. And that is definitely not an unfamiliar place for me. And also there's, especially coming out of a poetry world where you really feel like the things that you value are not valued by the wider culture. And you can be in the little scene that celebrates itself and feel like, oh, right, we all do, you know, really like, Jack Spicer now, you know, everybody knows about him, so it's not interesting anymore. But then as soon as you step out into any other kind of world, I mean, no one gives a shit at all.
Yeah.
Not only that, but it's not that they don't care, it's that they actively dislike what you like.
I think what you're talking about here, especially with blog comments, is the fine line between being a genuine iconoclast, mm-hmm. who can in fact change her mind or adjust views and be engaged in a dialogue, and someone who is a full bore troll who is incapable of that,
mm-hmm.
who has to erect some mythical status to justify why they continue to express themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, I'm curious if at any point during the writing of this, you saw this guy more on the first in the first category, where he was getting pushback from people who didn't want to hear his perspective when it was legitimate. Mm-hmm. I mean, did you see him in that mold at any point? Or but it seems to me he clearly moves more into the second, more custom troll. But
right.
But I'm wondering, you know, if you considered the first.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's definitely, you know, as he goes into his backstory, you can see it's a full, there's a lot of inputs, and there's this idea of, you know, I think for me growing up, I had really wonderful teachers that always seemed to save me just at the right time, like right when I was feeling the most disaffected and the most like there's no reason to engage. There would always be somebody who would be like, just a little bit,
yeah.
And we're listening just a little bit, and you're valued in just this way. And it was enough to really be like, oh, right, there's a wider world out there than what the rest of what was going on was more that, like, you know, not more than anyone else, I'm sure, but just not fitting in and not feeling like the way that my brain worked had anything to do with the way everyone else's brain works. And that makes you feel crazy. I mean, they, especially for people who don't have privilege, you're made to feel crazy. You're made to feel like the reason you're outside is because of your failings and because of, you know, if you don't have money, that's because you've made the wrong choices. Or if you don't have this certain kind of power or prestige, it's because you're not towing the line. And so you get put in a place of having to decide, either I'm going to give up who I fundamentally am and who I think that, you know, the things that I love and value in order to fit in, or I'm going to retreat and go, you know, both retreat into myself and then also go on the offensive and say, no, you are wrong, and I've been told my entire life that I'm wrong, and I'm not going to take it anymore. And I think that psychosis is real, and that it is something that is not to be dismissed. I mean, the thing, it's like, if I just wanted to make fun of comment trolls, I wouldn't have spent years of my life writing a novel about it. I mean, I do think that I really worry about people who are in this marginalized space, even if they've put themselves there. But I also just don't understand quite how they've all gotten there, and how I feel like I've managed not to be there, but there's a lot of people that I know and people who are really close to me who didn't quite get there. And it's you know, it's tragic. And as funny as it is, because it's so ridiculous, it's also the amount of anger and vitriol and also just the perpetrating this misunderstanding is really heartbreaking to see. So in some ways it's trying to figure out, okay, instead of just saying, well, just never deal with those people and sort of erecting these things where it's like, as soon as someone misbehaves towards you, you cut them out of your life. If you do that, you'll end up with very few people really around you. So is there any other way or any other strategy? So I think probably, to take it one step further and to answer a question you did not ask, I do think it's probably ultimately a failure in that I didn't come through on the other side feeling like I now deeply understand where someone in the, you know, championing the George Zimmerman verdict, where that person might be coming from in any sort of real empathetic way. But the process does make it so I don't take it as personally anymore. I'm definitely not going to jump in and dive into the fray with my spear.
Well, this begs the question. I mean, how do you write about a fairly pellucid sociopath without driving yourself insane? If you're channeling something that emotional, you know, how do you get away from the computer and not take that with you?
Yeah, well, I think it actually was so. A lot of it was trying to figure out a way not to actually engage in real time with some people. I mean, the one thing sort of interesting that was happening right around the same time as in my professional life dealing with moderating comments and then also just sort of engaging with the poetry world in a professional way and not in a creative way. Which was very different, where it's just all built on reputation. And we had an area where people were really interested in building up reputations and tearing down reputations. And so separate from the content, just the way people did that was really interesting. But I also had right at the same time that this was happening, I had over email, so not phone call or face to face, I had a falling out with a family member who, this is my father, disowned me over email. So I was like reading an email that was.
And I thought getting a breakup message by text was
totally
bad. That's pretty, pretty wrong.
Yeah, but it was just this
no
thing.
No phone call or anything.
Yeah, and it was just, you know, this like long, I mean, it was very similar. It was just this long, very upset.
220-page
email.
Really
getting it. But it was just something where I was like, well, I can't email him back. Like, that's just not going to work. Like, this is not, this is not how this goes. But I was just like, so this is something that clearly, I'm sure I'm not the only one. People get this all the time. I also had, you know, family members who would go on any sort of public, anything dealing with my work in the public realm on the internet, like family members would come and read it and comment on it also.
Oh.
And so that was also something where I was like, I'm not going to respond to them through this.
Did they leave like critical comments or affirmation?
No, they were always very nice. But always just something that it's like, I don't know.
Did they commented on every single piece you wrote?
No.
Okay.
Thank God. No, just some. Did you read the Adderall Diaries, that Stephen Elliott book? So he talks about, I think in that book where he talks about his father going on Amazon.
Yeah. And, leaving the reviews for
him. Yeah. And so like, also having read that, I was like, oh, right, this is like, everybody has to deal with this in some way. And it is the most vexing, queasy, terrible feeling of being like, I mean, there's just no, I guess that feeling of being put in this very strange box and not being able to respond in kind made it so I then was like, I need to figure out basically a game board that I can play on. And so I was like, well, I will set up something that maybe I can. I actually, honestly, when I was working on it, I thought, well, this is great and there's some sort of therapeutic value to it, but also I was just having a lot of this sort of dark kind of fun of really letting my imagination run and trying different forms. I was like, oh, screenplay. Well, why not? Whatever. Like, we'll go and do these things. And then coming back and really revising and trying to refine and seeing like, oh, okay, well, how would this work? I really did not. The two things I wasn't thinking about almost ever were publication and reception afterwards, which usually is deadly, but every once in a while you let yourself think a little bit about it. But this, I was like, well, you know, no one would ever do this, so it's fine. I'm just sort of ranging around. And then also the reception, like from friends and family. Like I could go places because I, you know, really was like, I doubt I will even show this to anybody, really. I might read it out loud because I could. It is sort of, you know, it's a monologue, and so it could be interesting in a reading. But I didn't think that it would be something that would end up in book form until really late in the process. And then I sent it. I actually read from it and got a really nice response. And I should have known. I was reading at where I went to school, and there was a bunch of people that I knew who were there, and they're all slightly drunk. And so that their like really robust response might have had more to do with the context than the content. But I took that as a big pat on the back. And so then I sent it to a friend who read it and was also just like, this is amazing. No one will ever publish it, but, you know, good for you. And I thought, well, Coffee House is pretty adventurous. And I thought, Chris Fishbach, the editor there, I was like, he, you know, not if anyone would do it, he would do it. But I was like, I think if I could, the two positive responses that I got made it, so I was like, I will. I'll go ahead and send it to him, and we'll see what happens. And I did, and then like a week later, I read somewhere else, and it bombed miserably. And so if I would have had that situation reversed and had it bomb, I probably would have just shelved it. I mean, maybe, I don't know. Or tried to reconfigure it. But the reading in which it bombed, it was one of those, which I'm sure you've had too, this public... If you're up in front of people, like I was about four sentences in and I realized.
Yeah, they would never, ever get it. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was like, there's no, I should just stop right now because there's no reason to go on. And I mean, this was like, I was scheduled, you know, it should be about a 10, 15 minute reading, possibly even 20 minutes or whatever. And within 90 seconds, I was like, I'm dead in the water.
This is the closest quality that both theater and reading share.
Yeah.
Because you'll never, ever get a great house every single time. No. You'll have those terrible houses where nobody actually gets what you're doing.
Totally.
And especially if you're directing something and you have actors and you're there to you're there to support them. It's just like you have to go and no, you're great and it's.
Well, this I mean, this is also I've had it a couple times where I mean it is funny. That's my hope.
Yeah.
And I mean it's. You know, it's funny and sad, so it does both of those things. But usually I try to read because I know, you know, I've done enough readings now, not more than probably everybody reads all the time. But I feel fairly comfortable with the idea that funny is good. You know, people are going there for... There are people who do funny much better than writers, that's for sure. So you can't just do funny, because then why wouldn't you just stay home and watch Louis C.K. or whatever? But... funny is usually like mix it in, that'll be nice. So I try to do a little of that. And at the readings for this, where I know that I'm in trouble, is when no one laughs.
But why should that audience reaction from a reading matter for the future of your work? Because especially for something conceptual or something that has a thrust like this, you're dealing with something in which the reader has to use her imagination, in which the laughs are very often on the page and in the head.
Right.
And it takes some time, sometimes for some people, to actually vocalize those particular, that laughter or those emotions or what have you.
Yeah.
I you know, why this notion of approval through reading? It seems to me that's a hell
totally
of a risk because you'll never get any true voice down if you read a portion of it before a fucking crowd.
Yeah, totally. Well, you're exactly right. And I wish I had that perspective and maturity. I know from poetry readings that people, you know, the poems that go over best at the bar reading are your worst poems.
Yes.
Like almost all the time. And I think that there's right now, I feel like I've see enough stuff where I'm like, oh, you guys didn't learn that lesson. You're like, if you wanted to have a RoboCop poem, you know, I don't know if it needs to be in the book. That's not like, that's a good one at the bar, but not really in the book. But Yeah, I mean, craven desperation for approval gets me down. You know, runs me really off the road every time. But you know, I think that in the same way that if you are playing music or doing theater or doing any kind of performance, you want a reaction from the audience. And so, like, recently I did a reading from this book, and there was, like, no one laughed. And, like, I had that like, felt the trickle of sweat go down, and I thought, oh, God. But I also saw that, I mean, there were people who were really intensely listening. And so I was like, obviously, yeah. That's it. I mean, any way that people are engaging, that's what you want. And I think that, you know, some of the, again, the Pleiades there, where you're shooting for one thing and you get something else.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that most of those happy accidents end up being the best things. I mean, I think somebody asked me recently, it's funny, once you publish a book, then you get to, you know, say things in a really grand manner to people, and they'll be like, oh, okay.
I'll be sure to scratch my chin a little extra hard to encourage your profundities.
Right. Yeah, please do. That's, again, I crave and desperation for approval needs some chin scratching. I said, what advice would you give, you know, young writers and that sort of thing, which is, you know, there's nothing really useful. But I did think that the things that people have told me sometimes that are good, but also just like in life, one of the things that I've found is that doing things that I don't want to do.
Yeah.
And like, you know, the thing with writers and artists a lot of times is that you really don't want responsibility because you want that freedom for when the idea shows up that you can go for it. And I didn't have that for all that long in my life, but I have had it. But I found that that didn't necessarily mean that the work was better. Usually the work is better when I have a ton of things going on, and then I just happen to run myself ragged trying to get everything done and get the ideas down. It's like, oh, right, and then I can do this and do that. And when I have nothing going on and I have all that time to write, I end up just being, I mean, I don't now, but when I have had it, I end up just sort of being like, I could, you know, I could do that, but I have all this time and it's okay. So it's, you know, obviously it's like, you know, mom advice, but it's good advice where it's like, you need to have a balance. Sometimes you're busy, sometimes you're not, but take advantage. I mean, I think that's just it, is that as time, you know, gets winnowed, and most people, as they get older, you get more responsibilities, just as it happens. And so then it makes it so it's like, oh, right. When the idea does show up, if you can write it down and if you can pursue it, you should, because it probably isn't coming back.
My understanding is that during the writing of Wild Blue Yonder, you were inspired by Anselm Berrigan's idea of basically writing zeros and ones to blank his mind out for Zero Star Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do to blank your mind out for that book or this book? Because I know that you have talked in a few other interviews about the voice kind of burgeoning out of the blankness.
Right.
And, you know, I'm wondering, you know, how this goes on with you and whether this process is also part and parcel with trying to find the time or trying to chase the idea when it comes about as you get older and you have more responsibilities.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is where all of the good ideas come from, is from this sort of quieting of the mind, and then different voices come up. I think at that time, I was really trying to do, I was living in Seattle, working from home mostly. And working was mostly writing that novel and writing poems. And I worked at this bookstore, Bailey Coy. So I would not interact with people, and then I would go interact with people in a retail setting.
And that was your sole source of daily inspiration? Yeah, I mean, this was your sliver of humanity to draw from? And well, you did not leave the house in any other way?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting. I've just being here, I'm staying at a friend's apartment, and like, it's obviously very hot. And the inertia is just to stay in and do nothing. What I find now is very hard to quiet my mind enough to really let those other voices come in. I mean, I think that the both times, and probably with a lot of poems too, what happens is that I'm able to through a process of meditation or just, you know, the zeros and ones idea, one of the things that I would do is listen to singers that were that didn't sing in English. I was going to say vocalized music that is not English, but that
Tibetan monks,
yeah,
Gregorian
chants.
Yeah,
I mean, a lot of there's a Princess Nicotine was this. There was a series of things that came out. I'm totally blanking on the label, but it was run by some of the guys who were in Sun City Girls, and they would take, I mean, essentially just finding what to us seem like far off corners of the world and recording whatever music is on the radio. And they would put out a CD at that time. That's what it was. And so listening to that is just wild sounding. And also you would get all of this language that was not English. And then I would try to transcribe it, homophonic translation of like what that would be. If I was hearing English, what would that actually be?
And that's Spicerian of you.
Yeah. Right. And so then that would just pull me out of anything that I really wanted to say and get me into this sort of like, combining language, getting into the real, like the texture of it in the way that I feel like painters and like a materials and methods kind of thing, where instead of trying to come from a place of intention and being like, I really want to say this to this person, which is where, as I said before, I think that my base comes from of this like idea of wanting to communicate. So having that on one end and then having this materials and methods of just the language and the sounds on the other end, a lot of times they would cancel themselves out very nicely and give me a real blank feeling, where from that a voice would emerge that a lot of times I would just transcribe what I would hear. And, you know, that wasn't the Martians necessarily, but it was because I, you know, you can sort of theremin, you know, move your mind in a certain way when you feel you hear a sentence coming, and then you think, oh, I can hear it in the sense of hear it in your mind, and move it a little bit in a direction, but then still just trying to see how fast I could go and keep up with the things that would just sort of emerge from the blankness in my mind. And what, you know, a lot of times what you find is that there's just mostly garbage. I mean, a lot of it is just jingles and, like, you know, shitty Sheila E. songs or whatever it is from God knows where. And but then once you cycled through some of those, then there would be some other voices that would come up. Or sometimes you'd take that and realize that there's something really interesting about that thing that you heard, you know, a million times a day. If you watch sports on TV, you see the same 7 commercials 50 times, and so you just get, you know, Empire carpet commercial is just bludgeoned into your head. And so you have to do something to get that out of there. And so with...
This sounds like an extraordinary regimen. It's one that is an effort to combat a highly analytical, constantly deconstructing mind. Is that safe to say?
Not nearly as much as there are people that I know who are exactly like you're describing, and you can see how much effort it is for them to sort of
just chill, like, the fuck out.
Yeah, and like there's all this information coming at them, and they have to sort of grab neutralize yeah, as it's all happening. And you can, those are the people that I really I feel very sympathetic towards, and I also know that like their life is going to be hard. Like, yeah, they are artists in this way that like they do need help, and they need those. So coming back to what we were saying before, those are not the people that are just taking on the trappings. Those are the people that you can really see that you're like, ooh, you have a lot going on. You need this help. And I'm privileged and feel very lucky that I can get through the day without having that most of the time. But building up those defenses against that stuff does, I think, deaden some of the creativity. Yeah. So, you know, win some, lose some. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about this notion of moving horizontally across the surface of the language,
okay,
to create this voice for this book. You've,
sure,
described this in a number of interviews. The voice of this guy, I mean, he says things like, of course, this is the conclusion most people draw when they dimly perceive the outlines of my existence. But here's the strange thing. I am happy. This is, like, really formal.
Yes.
Uncannily formal. Even though I know, I happen to lurk and observe a lot of trolls for reasons...
Professional reasons.
Yeah, right. You know, and trolls often boast about how happy they are. But that notion of you know, dimly perceive reminds me of Mrs. Right. Dalloway's, mm-hmm. for that she can dimly perceive.
Mm.
You know, I wonder, did you just go to online pastures and rake across that, or did you go to 19th and 20th century or modernism or anything along those lines to create the formality, which is a little different from your typical Free Republic forum visitor?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I think, I mean, most of it is... one, I actually really like that formalism.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not formalism. I like that sort of Baroque language, and I feel like that there isn't a place a lot of times for it's like putting on airs in this way that is really frowned upon in contemporary fiction.
Oh yeah,
you know that it's just something that's like, oh, who does this guy think he is? Or fancy, look at you with that long.
Well now
Henry James.
It could actually change. We don't know.
Yeah. Right. I think that there's something in a lot of the comments that I was reading and also seeing is that the people who were like, you know, the 19th century was really when true art, you know, that's when, before modernism. It's definitely like we should just abolish everything that came after, basically, maybe you could get, well, basically everything after World War I. You know, it's just like wipe it off the map because that's when everything went downhill for a lot of people. When you go on, I mean, not even just like poetry sites or whatever, but just there are people that, you know, if you're on Reddit, literature subreddit, I mean, it really is just like there is beauty, and beauty is reflected by how much work that went into it a certain way. So it's like there's sort of an architectural view of it that it's like if there's definitely a, you know, my kid could do that. That idea, and so this.
So everything after World War I is useless. You're getting into my Ulysses, my friend.
Yeah, no, Ulysses is the worst.
The worst. Man. Yeah. Oh, dude, you are. Yeah. Oh, that them's fighting words.
Yeah. So again, this is this perspective.
Oh, yeah.
And this is not me.
Yeah.
But this is this idea that
among a certain type.
Yeah, for sure. That Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, you know, not the actual work of these people.
Yeah.
Because when you actually read, for example, War and Peace, it's insane. And there's all of these different things going on. It's incredibly experimental. Dostoevsky maybe is more like what they would like. And then also, of course, if you read Flaubert, it's like there is an idea that you think that it's writing in a certain way, but then it turns out that there's all of these other things going on. So it's definitely the same, you know, this guy, this narrator, he goes through a list of the artists that he really admires. And, you know, there's Thomas Eakins and Clint Eastwood. It's like two people that he loves, which is this idea. And in my mind, it's this idea. I actually...
well, he certainly is talking to an invisible chair.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that was probably one of the more interesting things for me that Clint Eastwood has done. He's like this idea of this sort of... if something is done... I guess it's more of classical than formal, but this idea of that there's a pure form and then an artist takes that pure form from the world of the gods or wherever it is, and then translates it cleanly into our world. And that's where a lot of these guys are coming from. And this idea of this muddled postmodern self-conscious, rough and smooth, is just trash. And so this guy's diction, yeah, where it comes from is this idea that he, like, let me show you the expansiveness of this art and what is possible through this language. And
let me art-splain you.
Yeah, totally. It's definitely art-splaining. That's great. And then also I liked the idea of everything. I mean, it's not consistent because that would be maddening, but many of the paragraphs are one sentence. And so this idea is that, you know, he's blah, 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 and then going and having these just sort of long breaths.
Yeah.
And so not like a... Like, he would be horrified at this idea of, like, a Charlie Parker, you know, Charles Olson projective verse kind of thing, but more of, like, that he's biblical, more. Yeah. And he's got this rhythm that is building this sort of grand cathedral of language.
The seductive caesuras throughout this book. they're actually... well, they're not so seductive as they are kind of illusory. Because, I mean, until we actually get to that whole Corin Rachel story,
yeah.
I mean, you just don't feel that there is a break at all from this guy until we see chapter one, chapter two, and all that. And I wanted to ask you about that as about like, well, you know, at first I thought, oh, well, this will be some sort of Marxonian nod to internet culture. And if anything, I was like, I both... You know, I was continuing to read breathlessly while also wanting to exhale.
Because I
had no break from this guy until, thank God, the fucking Corn, the Rachel Corn story shows up. So I want to ask, you know, how that formalism came about. Was this something that you did through your editor? Did you have a lot of test readers to kind of get that tension between the reader and the text, or what?
No, that's a great question, and it definitely is. I felt throughout, I mean, I probably only had five or six people who read it before publication. That's right. Yeah. But I always felt that if I could get them to that point, then I had it.
Yeah.
Because I feel like that's really when all of a sudden you can, like, oh, thank God.
And then you're like halfway through the book, very smart.
Yeah, right.
And they're like, oh, I'm in this far. I might as well finish it.
Yeah, I'm definitely not going to, you know, like.
what a clever Corbett-esque marketing strategy.
Right. That's what I did. I did a number of push polls to find out. But I thought, well, one thing that I felt like in writing the first novel, I was really trying to write something that would be acceptable and that would be something that you would. That would be a page turner in a certain way, obviously not in the exact traditional way, but in a way that you would like it and that you would be like, I want to know more out of this story. And so I wanted with this to go in the complete opposite direction of being like, to make it be a challenge. And obviously I wanted it to be pleasurable. I mean, there's enough experimental fiction in the world that, I mean, the... Ken Kesey's dad, I think, said, good writing isn't always good reading.
Yeah.
Or ain't always good reading. So I definitely didn't want to fall into that trap of it being something that was like good writing in quotes that was unreadable and
purdy.
Challenge. Yeah. For like, basically for me as a writer's benefit of feeling good about myself. But I wanted it to be a challenge in the sense that you would hopefully feel rewarded. I wanted to schedule out the rewards, essentially. Yeah. But I also really, to be true to the character and true to what I was getting at, is that feeling of being stuck in this relentless, you know, that this ideology, I think, which is very true, and also this mindset is coming at you in a way that is scary and is off-putting, and you would like to make it go away, but it's not going to go away. And it's something that so like getting to that point where you're saying you had that feeling is exactly what I was hoping for, in a way that, because it's art, in real life you don't get an out.
Yeah.
In real life you're stuck, and you have to get up and leave, or you don't. You might not have that option. And so with this, I wanted to evoke the feeling and then be able to say, okay, so we're in a different world now. So you have that feeling, but you know that I'm. Hopefully, I mean, it's written out of a spirit of generosity and not out of a spirit of meanness towards the reader. So the idea of like, okay, well, now we're in it together. And so I've built it halfway and you can come halfway, and maybe we can, that what you're getting, hopefully is generative to other people. I mean, the books that I always like are the ones that I put down and feel like give me space to write. And that is what I've tried to do a number of times. And in this book, I thought, oh, what would happen if I don't give the reader any space?
Yeah.
Like, really don't let them go, and that they will have to forcibly stop reading. Like, you're not going to necessarily... I would love to hear, actually, I should look on Goodreads or something, where somebody, like, put it down. Like, that's a very interesting response to me, as someone who would be able to like read it and be like, ooh, no. Is just as interesting in a certain way than the people who are like, okay, I'll keep going, this sounds interesting. Because like, what was it that, like, I mean, this doesn't, it's a very small sample and doesn't really matter, but I've had a number of the people who have really liked it. And one of the things Chris told me when he gave it to a couple of people at Coffee House is that he liked it, but then he said he wanted to give it to women readers to find out what they thought, because he felt like that's, it's going to sort of make or break if it's possible. And he said that
why is that exactly for this particular book?
Well, because the idea of putting something out into the world that is just another version of what people have to deal with every day, especially women have to deal with every day if they're writers or in the public at all, and so it probably doesn't have anything to do with being a writer or an artist, but it can be, because that's what I... To me, it seems that way, because that's where I look, that you're subjected to this mentality and this type of sort of... you are put in this tractor beam.
I mean, I'm wondering if he was thinking of, like, for example, the woman behind Feminist Frequency, who was doing, she did this Kickstarter to do this wonderful video series about video games and feminism in video games.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in the early stages, when she did this, she was completely just trolled left and right by a bunch of men.
Right.
And luckily, she was able to raise the funds anyway, and now her series has been going on, but she still has to endure that. And most women these days have to endure this in some way, that when a woman expresses her opinion, the whole thing on Kamau Bell with the, I'm blanking out on her name, it was the stand-up comedy thing with...
Lindy West.
Yeah, Lindy West, thank you. Mm-hmm. And similar situation where she was just completely all this terrible abuse. Yeah. Was this kind of the reason why?
That's great. I mean, that's the way. It's just that, like, the... I haven't really talked about this, and it seems like something I can really screw up talking about, so I want to try to get it right.
Sure, sure.
But the idea that if every woman who read the book thought, this is not only just another, like, boy fiction book, but it's also, like, boy fiction troll book, this does not need to exist. Yeah. Like that, I mean, that is just out there in the world. There's no reason to do it. But I felt like if there was something there, like I gave it to tonight, I'm doing an event with Emily Gould at Word, and I'd given it to her to look at. And she at first was like, you have gone down a very strange road. And what she ended up writing about is that, you know, we sort of worry for you because you seem to have embodied this character so much.
What? Really?
Yeah.
Like, but, worried for you.
Yeah. But she felt like it was ultimately a rewarding experience because, and my hope is because it drew all of that into its orbit and then was able to more thoughtfully than you would if you just have to deal with it on an everyday basis, be able to engage. And hopefully then also bring up, I mean, one of the things that I've really have been hoping for the book that so far has been there and not there is to provide a context and a reason for having a discussion about these things. And I mean, we're having it now, which is really great. But it's one of those, like, I feel like it won't have done what I had hoped it could do with its audience if it doesn't have more engagement from women readers. Because I feel like I see, and, you know, we all read, I mean, it's like, it's just I mean, we were talking just a tiny bit about Tampa, which I have not read more than first two chapters of, but
which has also interestingly been pissing off certain women.
Yeah, I'm sure
women either love that book or hate it. I loved it, by the way.
Yeah. Well, so this
and I wish she wasn't pregnant because I would be happy to talk with her. But I love that book. But it is interesting that it does come down in some way to women readers. Mm-hmm. Any book these days.
Hmm.
You were mentioning rewards earlier,
mm-hmm.
and giving the reader rewards. How can you, I mean, is it even possible to tell the whole truth these days in fiction? I mean, are we always going to have to compromise or sand things down a bit these days, perhaps more than ever before, you know, do you think? Or I mean, do you feel that you had to to compromise at certain points because of these realities that we're talking about during the writing of this book.
Oh, no. I mean, I didn't feel like I compromised at all. Like I was saying before, I mean, I was just sort of going just to see where I would end up. And I mean, the interesting thing, I compromised in the sense that like there would be like a little bit of, I'd be going and then the sort of voice, and mostly longhand actually writing it out. Sorry, I realized it's on the radio. I was miming writing longhand. So writing it out, and the voice would come in and this character would say something that I'd be like, well, I'm not even going to write that down. Yeah. Like I can't let that out of my brain. And so I would compromise in that way, where the can't was because usually it was because it wasn't quite true to the character, but then it would also just be there are things that like, well, sure, that exists in the world and someone could say that and it could be incredibly hurtful and awful and mean and like just disgusting, but is there any reason to what separates this from you know, really the worst of the worst online?
The more you ignore me, the closer I get. You're wasting your time.